welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 191. With me this week, everybody, you know, it's James.
Hey.
It's Greg.
Hello.
And it's John.
What's going on, everybody? It's good to be here.
My name's Jonathan Metz. I'm your host. And before we kick off with all the games and such, I wanted to give everybody an update on the retroactive poll. This was our Game Boy edition. It was all black and white or color Game Boy games, no GBA. And the poll ran for 2 weeks. We had a lot of votes, a lot of participation, a lot of comments on it. In the end, the winner was Metroid 2 Return of Samus. Probably was the favorite to begin with, but actually Wario Land 3, which came in second, I was able to watch the poll results as they went, and for a while Wario Land 3 was extremely close, and I thought it might win, but in the end, Metroid 2 pulled away, especially in the past couple of days. So that's the one we're going to play next. It'll probably be 2 or 3 weeks from now, because we're going to have to grab our own copies of the game. And also, I should let you know, we are taking off next week. We've decided that with the NFL draft and some other stuff going on, and I'm going to be getting ready to move halfway across the country temporarily, it's probably better that we don't have a show next week. But actually, I think there probably will be something for you to listen to from an old friend. So keep an eye on your iTunes feed or whatever it is you do to keep up with the show, because there might be something to listen to around the regular time next week, but it won't be us. And then we'll be back after that to pick up with 192. On the road to 200. Scary. Really, really scary. Okay, every week we have this thing that's called New Business. And John Lindemann is up first.
I feel like I'm in some sort of like rap, like posse cut. And Johnny, take the microphone and take it home.
Oh, okay.
Naturally.
People often think of hip-hop when they listen to me. I get that a lot. You have no idea. If I had a nickel for every time.
So it's that big clock necklace you're wearing, Johnny. You should take it off.
Man, you guys can't see it, but this thing, I'm getting...
You get neck strain from it.
This bling is really, really rough on my upper back.
All right. If I can actually stop myself from laughing out loud for several minutes. I got a copy of Final Fight Double Impact. Mm-hmm. One of the many perks of being director is that you have codes for these downloadable games dropped into your lap, along with, you know, limousines, ladies, jets, stuff like that.
and my eternal torment.
That's not how I remember it.
And the limousines are also for non-Nintendo formats.
And yeah, so this is a retro. It's not a straight port of Final Fight, the arcade versions of Final Fight and Magic Sword.
Magic Sword. Yeah.
It's actually pretty cool the way they set it up. You start off and there's two arcade cabinets in front of you when you load it up. You know, you press start and it shows you these two cabinets, kind of like, and you can swivel between each one. And the way that they present the game on the screen, you don't play it like you would a normal game full screen or even clipped on the sides. It actually shows you the surrounding area of the arcade cabinet, of the real arcade cabinet, with a little bit of wear and tear like you would see in a dingy arcade somewhere. And so it's pretty cool the way they do it, and you can actually have a choice between playing normally kind of offline by yourself kind of thing, but since both of these games are co-op, you can also choose to play with anybody, just people on your friends list, and I think that's it. But you completely have a choice whether or not you want to play, you know, online co-op or just co-op with, you know, somebody else, you know, in front of the old television. But yeah, I mean, if you like these games, I mean, I can't really think of a better way to actually experience them, because you kind of get the ambiance of playing them on the arcade cabinet along with actually just, you know, it's not like, you know, playing something on VC where you're just...
Yeah, the presentation reminds me a little bit of the whole Williams Collection pinball mm-hmm. stuff, because
very
that
true.
Was like set in an arcade, and it's as if you're going up to these pinball tables. But you do have various options in terms of you can play without the borders on, and you can play with different filters, some, you know, just kind of look at it in its raw sort of pixely glory, or, you know, sort of one filter that kind of smooth it out a bit and make it look a little bit cleaner. But Yeah, I mean, you know, you can pretty much tailor it however you want, and it's Final Fight. I mean, obviously, if you've only ever played the Super NES version, I'm sure you'd be impressed by the additional character, additional level, and various forms of multiplayer.
Yeah. I don't know if impressed is the word.
Yeah, exactly.
So I picked this up, too, and I didn't get a code for it. I bought it on Xbox Live Arcade. But I do think it's a good package. I wish this was coming to WiiWare. Maybe just the kind of emulation they're doing isn't really compatible with Wii, or it wasn't designed for it. But
yeah,
or they just decided not to.
Well, and the online is like kind of a big part of it as well. Isn't it? It's like you play online by default.
Yes.
In terms of like someone could jump in and into your game.
Right, and that's kind of the way it used to be in the arcades. You know, you could start playing Final Fight in the arcade, but you know, random stranger X could show up and pop in a quarter and join you. And you don't really have that much to say about it. You'd probably be happy because they're going to help you.
Yeah.
Because these are co-op games. But yeah, it's really cool. I mean, you just start playing by yourself, and then, you know, maybe you're halfway through the first level and somebody pops in and starts playing. That happened to me, and it was, they didn't stick around for very long, but it was neat. You know?
Yeah.
They jumped out the next second.
The downside is you can't pause. Because it's online and people are
bathroom.
Trying to join your game. Yeah, it kind of sucks.
Yeah, I was actually surprised at how well Final Fight holds up, actually. It's still a pretty fun game.
Really?
It's I thought it was pretty fun. I mean, it's simplistic, but once you once you kind of figure out how to do the pile driver move, you can pretty much do it on everybody. Like, you just kind of wait for them. You just go above them and then wait and just kind of walk down into them.
It's like 1980s wrestling.
Final Fight is the art of getting everyone on one side of the screen.
Yeah.
That is the game.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mainly bought it for Magic Sword.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that. I haven't played very much of that part yet.
Yeah, I'm probably really in the minority of people who actually care more about Magic Sword than Final Fight. But, you know, both of these arcade games were ported to Super Nintendo, as Greg mentioned. And Final Fight was very, very common Super Nintendo game. I had friends who owned it. You know, we rented it, whatever. The Super Nintendo version, not that good. But,
no.
But Magic Sword, although I'm 99% sure that it did exist on Super Nintendo, I have never seen a copy of it. I've never played it on Super Nintendo. Always wanted to.
I've only ever played it in the arcade, and that's it.
I love the arcade version. I always wanted it for home, and I just, you know, I could never find proof that it was out there available.
Yeah.
So maybe they just made a few copies of it or something. I don't know. But Magic Sword is really fun, and it's I'm not exactly sure what to compare it to.
It always struck me as a really weird arcade game.
It is a bit. It feels a little more like a console game, really.
Yeah.
Because it's quite long, and it has some very minor RPG elements and things like that. It's very, you know, it's Dungeons and Dragons style.
Mm-hmm.
It's a bit like Golden Axe, but on a strictly 2D plane, so there's no depth in the field. And there's platforms. You can jump up on platforms. You jump in and slash and stuff. There's a lot of different items you can get. Shields and swords and magic scepters and, you know, scrolls and things. And not only is it co-op, but even if you're playing alone, you can rescue these friendly characters from their cages, and then they'll fight with you and add to your attack power. And there's a lot of different ones, and they all have different attacks. So it's really neat, and it's just a game that I had this real fondness for when I was a kid, and I haven't played it in ages and ages and ages. So that was the main reason I got into it. But I have been playing Final Fight as well, and I don't think it's really fun.
Well, it's the kind of thing that you just, I mean, you play through once, and you get your fill of it pretty quickly. I mean, it worked really well as kind of a quarter muncher. I mean, really, what you're buying this for is, or what you should be buying it for, is Magic Sword, so.
Well, yeah, I liked Final Fight when I was a kid. I was never a huge fan of it. Nothing like Ty Sugart, certainly, who's totally obsessed with it.
Well, let's never compare ourselves to Ty Sugart.
Yeah, but I respect Ty's fondness for it, and I think he mainly likes it because it's funny, and there are some things about it that are funny.
It's funny.
You know.
Yeah,
like when you bash the car in the bonus stage, and then some dude comes out of the side of the screen and says, "Oh my god!"
Yeah,
that's funny.
Yeah,
you know, it's cheesy, but man, the gameplay just—I think it sucks. I really do. I don't think it's a fun game at all. I just don't. I mean, it's probably more fun in co-op.
Oh, those games always are.
It's just a beat 'em up of the simplest kind, really.
It's so straightforward.
I mean, I have to say, Double Dragon on NES has a lot more depth than Final Fight. Seriously.
Well, that's because it's double, not final.
Well, Double Dragon, you learn new moves, and there's strategy and using the right moves against the right characters, and that's co-op too. But
there's also just throwing on the Game Genie and calling it a day.
That too.
No, I think Final Fight was one of those, that was heavily leveraged on its technical prowess for the time, the big sprites and, quite a lot of enemies on screen
and all this
kind of stuff, which is why it was a kind of a big deal when it was on the Super NES, and it's, oh, wow, it's kind of like the arcade version.
Yeah, and it was kind of riding the wave of the, brawlers were, a huge genre back then.
There was a lot more de rigueur back then than they were a little afterwards, because the one-on-one fighting genre with Street Fighter 2 became very dominant.
I kind of like the Simpsons beat-em-up game back then. I feel like it had probably a little more variety than Final Fight.
Well, you got to hit things with the park bench.
And it was funnier, and it had four different characters who actually felt kind of different. But the only beat 'em up I ever really played a lot in the arcade was X-Men.
Well, that probably goes for everybody,
Well, that was by Konami, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
The great thing about X-Men is it had so many characters to choose from, and they were all legitimately different. They played differently, and the mutant powers were so awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that makes sense because Konami did the Turtles games, if I recall correctly.
Oh, yeah. X-Men is basically Turtles in Time with the X-Men.
With lasers, yeah, basically.
Yeah.
With new sprites.
With teleporting and Colossus using some kind of crazy explosion power that he doesn't have in the comics.
Yeah.
Well, they had to give him something.
Or he's just Russian. They could have, drank something. I don't know.
Drank some Ciroc.
That's not what they drink in Russia, but yeah. So, John, did you have anything else?
I've just kind of went back. I was actually playing my 360. I dusted it off and turned it on after a long hiatus. But yeah, I started playing Modern Warfare 2 again, and I know, Johnny, you were kind of curious about my thoughts on multiplayer, because I really haven't played Modern Warfare 2 since it first came out.
And I haven't played the multiplayer at all yet.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm putting it off for some day in the future. I don't know. I didn't mean to put it off this long, but because it's been put off this long, it's going to get put off until I get back from Texas, I can tell you that.
Well, it's always going to be there. I'm sure.
It's true. I mean, even the first one still gets played a lot.
Yep. So, I started off, I think, as I was a level 2 out of, I don't know, what is it, 70 or 80 or something like that. And
probably.
then you can probably, I think, flip over and do the prestige mode, which strips you of all your guns and your perks and everything and lets you start over and get super hardcore.
So it's basically, I want this game to suck mode.
Yeah, pretty much.
I don't want to have fun mode.
It's punish yourself mode.
No comment.
So I started playing, and I played the first one quite a bit, and it was interesting because I kind of came at it with a fresh pair of eyes, and I was able to sort of see, because the first thing I know Johnny asked me about this was what's the matchmaking like, because I think the matchmaking in the first one really didn't exist. I mean, it pretty much just threw you in with whoever.
Well, I mean, the problem was that there were so many players who played it 24 hours a day that it was impossible to avoid one of them.
Yeah, and I mean, this game, for that, I mean, Modern Warfare 2 is probably worse. But I think their matchmaking has improved a little bit. I don't find myself, because I know when I first started playing the original Modern Warfare, I was just getting the floor mopped with me every single time I went out. I mean, I don't know. I don't think that my skills have improved to the point. I mean, I guess I know the controls better, but I mean, I don't think that really my skills have improved at all. But it just seems like the matchmaking is a little bit better. I'm at least semi-competitive. I mean, I've never, I think my kill to death is terrible. It's like a .5 or something, but I mean...
Yeah, but you play enough shooters that...
Yeah.
I'm sure you're okay with the fundamentals at least.
Yeah, I remember in the first one, I got up to .7 and I was like, yes!
Yeah.
I'm the best player I know at this game.
Yeah, well, with this, I mean, I just completely threw it out the window. I was like, you know what, I'm just going to go here. I'm just going to go on and just try to compete as best as I can and just kind of have fun with it. And, there's some times when, you absolutely get destroyed, and, I've had matches where I'll get two kills and I'll get killed 15 times. And, but those really, I mean, most of the time I'm usually hovering right around 500, which is okay. I mean, as long as I can get, maybe get one good kill streak in there so I get to, set off a a bomb or set off the radar or whatever the heck kind of perk you have set. Now, bear in mind, I was exclusively playing team deathmatch because there's no way I would go in just deathmatch because I'd get...
Oh, no, because you'd be annihilated.
I'd get killed. But even in team...
You'd have a 0.0 kill to death ratio.
Absolutely. I mean even with team deathmatch... It was so funny because you would have like the 8-on-8 teams and it would be like 55, 60, 65, 70, 70, 4. And then you would look at the other team and it would be like 55, 60, 70. You know, I'm like the only, you know, 4. And, you know, every once in a while you get somebody in there like, oh, geez, we got a 4 on our team, you know, because you feel like a complete idiot because, I mean, it's obvious that you haven't put much time into the game unless you've switched your ID or something or done something crazy like that.
It is fun when you kill like a level 70 guy, though.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. That's what's kind of cool about it is the fact that you can still, like, get over on people. I mean, anybody can kill anybody. It's like, even though people have better perks and, you know, that's one more thing that's kind of changed.
That's the worst part of that game, though.
Well,
it really is. Hey, these guys have played way more than anybody else and are better. Let's make them even better. It would be like if in golf you were the number one golfer in the world, you got 5 strokes removed from your score.
Yeah.
It's like, well...
Yeah, that was one of the problems I had with Modern Warfare as well, where... You know, right out of the gate, you get people. I mean, you get rewarded for playing more than anybody else because you keep getting perks, you keep getting ranked up, but I find that the perks aren't as crazy, they aren't as out of whack anymore. That goes with the maps too. There were some maps in Modern Warfare where I remember there was one where there was like a cave right in the middle, and so when you go in there, people could just camp out and just kill people as they walked into the cave.
Yes.
And you had to go through the cave to get to the other side. And I just hated that level because you could have some people, like, you know, one person who would just go in there with, like, who was, like, really good at throwing grenades. And as soon as you poked your head into the cave, they would kill you instantly. And it was just completely stupid. And I haven't found any maps like that so far. It's a lot more like you'll kind of have areas that a team can take. And, you know, like kind of play like King of the Hill with, like there'll be like a house where a team can move in there and sort of set up shop and then hold you off as you try to take it over.
But you can't, it's not like a Battlefield game where you can respawn in that site.
You know, you can, there's ways like you can evade everybody and kind of go down the hill and come back up behind the house and hop up and, you know, climb something and get up and then come up behind everybody and kill them and stuff like that. So it just seems like it's not as easy for people to exploit the maps, you know, to really take out players that don't know
That's
them.
That's good.
That don't know the maps as well.
Because, I mean, the primary example in the game was the Priapit level, which had the two buildings where if you found yourself between the buildings, you were going to die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you first played the game, you would spawn right in front of the area between the buildings. Like, oh, I'm going to go this. Oh, I'm dead. Mm-hmm. What happened?
Yep.
So, yeah, I'm glad you're getting ready for the Conduit too.
That's right.
That's tenuous as all shit.
Looking forward to it, Johnny.
All right. Well, you give me a little hope, John, because when I do finally dive into some multiplayer, first off, my priority is to play some co-op, hopefully with you.
Yes.
So I've heard very, very good things about the co-op mode, and I do want to try that. But yeah, eventually, I mean, I really enjoyed the multiplayer in the first Modern Warfare. I didn't play it that much, but I always had a good time when I did. And I got into that one really late, too. Like, I didn't start playing multiplayer in the first one until, like, 9 months after the game was out. Because I didn't have my Xbox until...
Oh, no!
So I'm used to it. I'll adapt.
Yep.
So Greg's up next with something quite different.
And now for something completely different. I got Final Fight today, kind of as I alluded to earlier, and I've also been playing Pilot Wings on the Japanese Virtual Console, so
nice.
It's like reliving the Super Famicom's launch from the end of 1990.
So Greg, you got Double Impact on PSN?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I got a Double Impact on PSN, so, you know, it's kind of nice. I like Final Fight. It's so simple. I mean, it's silly, brainless stuff, but I got a little soft spot for it from playing the Super Nintendo version. It is kind of funny to see the other side of it, the proper side. But I am very much intrigued by Magic Sword. That's really why I kind of went with it. And Pilot Wings is, yeah, I mean, it's so tech demo-y, much more so than its successor on the N64, you know, which was also a launch game, so it could have been sort of equally guilty
Yeah.
But I feel like Pilot Wing 64 feels very much more well-rounded as a game.
Is this your first time playing Pilot Wings?
Not playing. I played it very briefly, a friend's copy, many, many years ago. This is the first time I've owned it and I've put in some real time with it. You know, for me, it's kind of like a neat little piece of Nintendo history. I'm not kind of interested to play it. But, you know, I mean, I'm fully aware of the kind of limitations of the game coming in. You just got these sort of few little kind of events, sort of, that you just do, you know, over and over again. But it is a neat little piece of Nintendo history. Although I think F-Zero is definitely the better Mode 7 launch game.
Oh, no question.
Yeah.
It's certainly the more full-featured one.
But what I've been playing quite heavily for the last couple of weeks through to completion is Darksiders for the PS3. This is a THQ-published game developed by Vigil, I think a pretty new outfit, under the direction of Joe Madureira, who was a famous comic book writer and artist, which I kind of have some familiarity with him, because I'm a big fan of The Age of Apocalypse, which he was heavily involved with.
Oh,
the X-Men.
Wow. You're bringing me back, man.
Yeah, I really like The Age of Apocalypse because it was contained. That's what was great. You know, it was like new characters, new story arcs that were going to end after those four issues of everything.
Is this when, like, Wolverine was dead or had an eye patch or something? And
no, he had one hand cut off in this reality.
Yeah, and Apocalypse had, like, killed God and was, like...
No, he hadn't killed God, it was... Professor X's nutso illegitimate son went back in time to kill Magneto, accidentally killed Professor Xavier, creating a nightmare timeline where everything went really wrong and Apocalypse ruled the world and was about to start a nuclear war with Europe. So it was very grim. But I had the soft spot for the art style and stuff like that. One thing I noticed is he always draws big characters with these enormous legs that are sort of continuous. It's just where there really isn't a beginning to the ankle or an end to the calf. So it just sort of runs as this sort of tree trunk thing.
Tube legs.
Which is what John Mann calls that a cankle. Right.
Oh, no.
When he observes it on these offensive linemen that are, you know, built like brick shithouses. So it's just playing Darksiders, I'm looking at the back of this character all the time, I'm just thinking of Madden all the time, you know. This is what you've got to put up with.
Everything leads back to John Madden.
It does.
Hey,
we miss you, John.
Oh, no.
We miss you. But so Darksiders, I mean, it got pretty well received sort of game, it got pretty decent reviews.
Mm-hmm. Very
but,
good.
I mean, in terms of how I came to get it, first of all, predictably, as you should know by now, it was going for good prices on online retailers over here. But they also, previous to that, put out a demo a little time after, at least, the game had actually come out. And it was quite an unusual demo, because the demo was an entire section of the game, as is, out of context, just dropped in there.
Hmm.
Not the beginning of the game, or not like carefully selected bits. It was just this huge slice of the game just put out there as a demo, which is quite weird. And the reason why that kind of intrigued me was because basically Darksiders, if you don't know, is a really shameless ripoff of Zelda in most respects. I mean, it is shocking, the direct one-to-one sort of thievery that's going on in places.
But this
demo.
You mean flattery, right?
No.
Well, depending on your point of view, I suppose. But this demo was one big Zelda dungeon. That's all it was. You know, this huge demo, really. You know, so it goes on for, it could go on for, you know, 2 hours, I think, really, depending on how long you take to solve the puzzles or whatever. So it's a pretty big slice of the game. And I thought, well, you know, let's try and really see, you know, what it's about. And I enjoyed the demo. I thought it was a really good dungeon, and you know, the puzzles were, you know, pretty satisfying. I assumed it was an earlier part of the game, so it's certainly not as complex as things that were to come. So I thought, oh, this seems really good. So I picked it up, and then when you see the actual beginning of the game, the choice of the demo seems inspired, because the beginning of the game is rocky, to say the least, because they don't, even though it is this massive Zelda knockoff, they spend the first few hours of the game trying to convince you that it's not like that at all. It's like all combat based, and the combat is some heavily derivative of God of War. It's just based on what I've read, and also I played the God of War 3 demo, and even just from that little sampling, it's pretty obvious where they're taking much of this stuff from. Although I suppose the biggest difference is that for the sort of quick timey portion, there's basically just one button. Like this, the quick time button basically is like the finishing move button. That's it. They kind of leave it, pretty simple in that regard, I suppose. Although at least it isn't kind of cumbersome at any point. But it's like it's all this combat, and it really made me laugh at one point. You get this portion leading up to one of the dungeons. We have I basically have five timed kill room challenges in a row.
Oh god,
which is just so bad. It was really tough. Oh god, is this a huge mistake?
So this begs a question, Greg. If you had not played the demo, do you think you would have given up on the game before you got to the good parts?
Well, I mean, it was testing, and I mean, maybe I wouldn't have explicitly said to myself, "Oh, this is rubbish. I'm giving up," because you've read reviews and stuff that suggest what's there. It still might have been easier for me to drift towards other games, and sometimes when you drift towards other games, you don't come back, or at least for a long time.
Right.
So that certainly the demo was useful in anchoring my interest to go through this stuff. But the thing that really cracked me up is that later on in the game, there's another string of time kill room challenges that you have to go through to beat the toast. And there's a dialogue scene where the character you're playing as, War, one of the horsemen of the apocalypse, it realizes that he's going to have to do this again, and he just goes, "There must be another way." Like, he knows it's awful. Like, he knows this is terrible. This is absolutely shitty
character?
Padding in the middle of the game, and he's got to do it again. So, I quite that's probably my favourite part of the dialogue, actually.
So maybe there is another way that you just didn't find.
Nah, I don't think
so. No other ways.
It's so strange because once the game gets going, it starts to really hit you with the puzzle, the Zelda dungeon stuff, pretty much consistently. I mean, there's a few iffy interregnums into sort of Gears of War third person shooter territory. I mean, whatever it is, it's taken from something else. Let's just put it that way. But the thing is that normally when you get these people that just take stuff wholesale, or it's like this mentality of like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if this bit from this game was in? Oh, then it's like this game, then it's like that game. It suggests a certain bankruptcy of imagination that would lead you to think that.
It would lead you to think
that there isn't very much talent here, and therefore that when they do nick the concept, the execution isn't going to be very good.
Can I make a comment? Let me repeat that it is a THQ game we're talking about here.
But in fact, I think the execution in a lot of areas is actually really quite good. The dungeons are, I think, well constructed. There are some really clever puzzles in there. And these dungeons are really quite large. I mean, there's not that many of them. And it is shorter than a Zelda game. And there is a significant amount of this padding, which is, not that great. So, I don't know whether it really stacks up with, for a Zelda fan with the real deal.
Now, do you have a fairy-type creature helping you out during all of this?
You have Mark Hamill as Navi.
What?
Mark Hamill doing his Joker voice is basically Navi in the game. That's it.
Oh,
he gets to tell you over here. It's one for one. It's a bloody allegory. It's incredible. Everything. There's pieces of heart. There's the hook shot. There's the boomerang, which is actually the thing from Krull, so it's sort of derivative squared.
I'm impressed.
Everything is stolen from everywhere. It's amazing. It is so much like Zelda, but the one thing is these dungeons are really big, and the way it deals with auto-saving and checkpoints is you don't get into that problem with Zelda where, you end up, if you die or you need to just save and come back, you sort of start at the dungeon entrance, and then there's this whole kind of plodding around, getting back to where you were and all that. I mean, if that you had that in these dungeons, it would be a problem because they're just physically very large. The environments are quite grand. So it's kind of auto-save, so it allows them to make the dungeons more, combat leverage predictably, places and all this sort of stuff. But you could just kind of keep ploughing through, and it's kind of accessible in that way. And later on, there's some more complicated puzzle stuff where they bring in basically the portal gun, where you get some pretty cool puzzles around a kind of reduced form version of the portal gun,
Wow.
But it's... breathtaking. I mean, you know, it's got to be the most brazenly derivative game I've heard of since Great Gianna Sisters or whatever it was. You know, I mean, it is astonishing, but enjoyable. I mean, if you're a Zelda junkie like me, you know, these dungeons are going to scratch that itch. Now, whether, you know, we necessarily pay full price for something that is kind of a knockoff is, you know, well, debatable, you know, especially $60 for a HD game. But if you can find it value, you might find it does some good things for you.
Well, in my case, I wanted to rent it. And
yeah, the similar thing.
I was mentioning an email before we started recording that I've been hoping to get Darksiders for a couple of months now because I'm quite curious to play it for all the reasons that you suggested, and I am looking forward to playing it eventually. But I'm learning that the Gamefly queue really is random because it doesn't seem to matter the order that you put things on there because. Instead of Darksider, when I sent back Ghostbusters after like 2 days, because I mean it, like, you know, I went over that last week, but I was really hoping to get Darksiders or something else, and instead they sent me Bioshock 2, which I didn't even remember putting on the queue, but if it was on there,
they
must
put
have
it on
been,
there for you.
It must have been at the bottom of the list. I mean, it had to have been because I really have fairly little interest in playing Bioshock 2.
Could you bait the system by taking everything but the game you want off your queue?
So you only have one game?
Yeah.
I think they pretty much require you to have like at least 5, and they recommend at least 10. But man, it's not, you know, I have Netflix too, and Netflix is pretty reliable about sending something from the top.
Yep.
And if it's not number 1, it's number 2.
Yep.
And man, Gamefly, it just seems totally random. It could be, it just doesn't matter what order you put things on. I don't understand how people game it, where they, you know, they try to get the first copy of the game right when it first comes out and then buy it for the keep it price and save like $20. I don't understand how people do that because I can't even get it to send me a game that's been out for a year that I actually really want to play. So
denied.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm not going to talk about Bioshock 2, but I am going to talk about Cave Story briefly. I know it was on the Newscast Game Club last week, and they covered it in some respects. For me, I bought it the day it came out, and I played through most of it, and got to the final boss, and pretty much got owned, and wasn't really sure the best way to go about beating him. And so finally I was like, well, I know there's some, you know, when you play through the game, it's pretty clear that there's some extra weapons. There are some sort of branching paths through Cave Story that affect the story, but also upgrades that you get to your movement, to your weapons, etc. Even, you know, your life point totals and things like that. So I was like, you know, maybe I should just start over because it's a short game. I mean, you can play through the whole game in 3 hours if you know what you're doing. The first time took me longer, but it's not humongous. And so I thought, well, let me start over and I'll try to do everything differently. So I'll try to get like the most different playthrough possible. And in order to do that, I went to GameFAQs. And I don't know if I ever talk about this, but I'm pretty much a GameFAQs whore. I will, if I, and there's a question about this later, but if I run into the slightest annoyance or frustration at a game, I might try something 3 times maximum before I run the game.
Is this the Nintendo rule now? Is that how Nintendo's conditioned you? If you try 3 times and it doesn't do anything, well, then you have to resort to drastic measures.
Well, let me say this. If I think there are more than 3 things that I could try to do, then I'll exhaust all possibilities. But if I'm pretty sure I'm doing it right and I do it 3 times and it still doesn't work, I'm like, fuck this, because I'm, you know, I'm not ready to stop playing the game, but I'm not ready to sit there for 3 hours and hammer through it either. And a lot of times I just find that, to me, GameFAQs is the cure for bad design also. And I'm not saying Cave Story has bad design, but a lot of other games do. You know, and I mean, like Rogue Squadron is a classic example of this, where the game wants you to do something very specific in order to complete this mission, but they don't really explain what it is. Mm. Or even worse, they tell you what they want you to do, but they want you to do it a certain way, and they don't tell you how to do it.
You might get a picture of the target that they tell you to take it out, but not really how to get rid of it.
Yeah. And it's just like when games are too vague or when they're deliberately or not, when they're confusing about what I'm supposed to do, about what the objectives are, I will go look it up. Because I don't play around with that, you know? I don't care enough.
It's not, it's not 1985 playing the NES, you know?
You get into a time issue.
Yeah, I got other things to do, man. I want to play this game. If the game won't let me play it, then I'll have to take drastic measures. So, anyway.
You're a loose cannon, Mets.
I'm a regular Steve Guttenberg, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So...
Boy.
Yeah. So anyway, I went to GameFAQs and read up on some of the places where you can diverge in Cave Story, basically. So anyway, I started over and played through again, did everything differently, had a really great time even playing through the parts that were the same, although a lot of parts, after a certain point, it became really quite different than the first time I'd played through. And I was going through mostly the same areas, but without certain upgrades I'd gotten the first time that made it easier. Because the way it works is if you kind of delay getting certain upgrades, you'll get much better versions of them later, which is it's a really nice payoff. But also what it does is it kind of gives you like a built-in hard mode because now you're playing through the same areas. But, oh, wow, this is a lot more challenging than it was the first time. But not in a crass way, in a way that, well, I just have to be a little more careful about how I move around and where I shoot, you know, and how I take care of my weapons. So it just made me kind of a better player. You know, it made me better at the game. It made me appreciate the level design a lot more. And then when I finally got towards the end, I started to collect my rewards for playing the game this way. It's like, holy shit, there's some crazy stuff they give you. And so now I'm back to the end again and getting ready to take on the boss again. And I expect it will be a very different outcome this time. with all the stuff I've collected. Cave Story is an amazing game. There's a lot more to it than meets the eye. You know, the other thing I want to remark on is that I've heard tons of people say that you should switch to the old music. People just don't seem to like the new music, and I think it's mostly people who played the PC version and have a certain familiarity with the original PC music. Whereas everyone seems to like the new graphics, and they do look great, but I haven't heard anyone really suggest that you play with the old graphics. But the music, everybody's like, switch to the old music, switch to the old music. And I tried it, and I had to go back to the new. I think the new music sounds fantastic. I think it's wonderful. It is a bit loud for the regular sound mix, so you might want to turn the volume down in the game options while leaving everything else up. But I think the compositions and the sound quality are great. I think it sounds way better than the original stuff. So, for what that's worth. But yeah, do any of you other three? I know Greg, you don't have access to Cave Story.
Still
right
waiting
now.
On that European date yet? We haven't even got a date yet. This is week three. The Cave Strike.
You will absolutely love it when you do finally get it.
That's the day of date jobber for me.
Oh yeah. But I know, James, you're not a huge fan of the whole Metroid thing, but it is a lot of Mega Man, too.
I played the PC game a long time ago, so I'm not super up on, you know, paying for it.
Yeah, well, that's fair enough. I mean, they didn't, you know, other than new graphics and new music, they didn't really add that much content to it. It's not like a sequel or anything. It is a remake. So if you played the PC version for free, I can understand that. You know, that point of view.
I have plans to get it, but it's in terms of that type of game right now. The first thing on my list is Shadow Complex. I still have yet to go through that one. So,
oh yeah, that is a hell of an experience. And John, you've got Metroid 2 as well now. So.
Yeah, I got to actually pick that up. I don't have a copy of that myself. So,
you sure you don't have a boxed copy lying on a shelf somewhere?
No. But I know where my copies are on my shelves, James. All right, I don't lose them. I don't lose them.
Obviously. Yeah. So actually, the amusing thing is, and maybe it's just, you know, I am so crazy for the whole Metroidvania thing. And Cave Story definitely fits in that genre, although it brings a lot of other stuff into it as well. So it's not just that, but, you know, that is definitely part of why I like it so much. And beyond that, I just love this kind of game so much that it's really not a problem for me to play one or two at a to play multiple ones at the same time.
I remember
time.
There was the episode where you had the, was it Shadow Complex and Prime Trilogy like chained together or something like this?
Yeah.
This has come up before, your ability.
Yeah, it's weird. I think that's actually one of my skills as a gamer, is to kind of keep track of these maps in my head of games like this, you know, and where things are, because that's really what they're about, you know, these exploration games. And but yeah, a game I've been playing simultaneously with Cave Story is Castlevania Symphony of the Night, which, you know, Greg alerted me to a few weeks ago as being available on the PSN store.
I did talk about it on the show. Before that, it wasn't a secret, and I wouldn't have got it from Xbox Live.
It's interesting, Johnny. I just played that the other night on my PSP. I have it. I got it for PS3, and of course, you can download it onto your PSP and play it. Plays perfectly.
Yeah, it's on PSP in a couple different forms. And I actually own a disc I own the original PlayStation 1 disc somewhere, but it's back home, and it's kind of scratched, and I bought it used a few years
ago. Any beer spillages on it? Was that what happened to John's?
No.
It was, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, mine was actually, water actually had spilled.
Oh, water.
Spilled on it.
I don't know why I would have seen it was beer.
No, what are you saying, Greg? Those days are behind me, man. I'm married now, come on.
Oh, no.
But Symphony of the Night is a game that, like Super Metroid, I can play through from start to finish every couple years.
Yeah, I never get tired of it.
I never get tired of it, basically. Yeah, so that's what I'm doing. I'm playing through it again. Mm-hmm. It hasn't been that long since I played it last time, but certainly I'm enjoying it. I think I actually enjoy it more every time I do it. I seem to like it more and more and more. And the really interesting thing now is that I have finally now played Rondo of Blood, which came right before it. And I actually played some more Rondo this morning, just to go back and compare it again. And man, there's a huge gulf between Rondo of Blood and Symphony of the Night. I mean, you know, obviously in terms of game design, they really don't even have that much in common in what kind of game that they are. But also, in my opinion, quality. I think Rondo is maybe the best of the old school 2D Castlevanias, but to me, it's not nearly as much fun as Symphony of the Night.
No.
And a lot of it comes down to mobility, because I really like playing games where the character moves fast and is acrobatic and is fun to control and has that fluid movement. And that's a huge obstacle for me in old Castlevanias. I mean, it's a series that I always kind of liked when I was a kid, and I respected it, you know, and I played all of them that I could get my hands on, but I never really considered myself a fan of Castlevania until I played Symphony of the Night back in the 90s, and I was like, holy shit, this is my game now, you know, I'm into Castlevania. This is what I was looking for.
Now, my only gripe with Symphony of the Night as compared to some of these more tightly honed sort of Metroid type experiences is the level design is kind of lazy in areas. They're just corridors of stuff to slash through.
Occasionally, but not.
I don't think it's as bad as in some of the latter day handheld.
That's what I was going to say. I think it got worse over time because Symphony actually has pretty good levels.
It has been worse in some of the successes, but
Portrait of Ruin is atrocious.
I avoided that one because that was such a common complaint. But it's still there in this one, which is the whole inverted castle is. The problem is you've got all these unique bosses, but there's no real order to them. So I kind of fought some of them just ridiculously overpowered, because I guess I kind of came to them later than maybe they thought I would, because you could just kind of go anywhere, because at that point you're so powerful.
And that can even happen in the first castle, because the game is quite non-linear, actually.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of kind of sequence flexibility, if not breaking, I guess.
Yeah, if you want, you can also grind yourself up, too. You can just sit there and spot.
Yeah, there's always that, because it is explicitly RPG character, like Super Metroid.
Right. See, that's one of the big differences between Symphony and any Metroid game is the RPG elements. And I guess partly because of that, Symphony is a lot more flexible and more nonlinear. Whereas Metroid, I mean, it's nonlinear in a sense that it doesn't tell you where to go most of the time. And you can certainly find some things out of order, but generally there is a place that you need to go next.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just kind of wanted to throw that out there. America's Test Kitchen is the last thing I will mention. I picked it up after seeing Andy's video blog of it, and I was going to pick it up anyway. I was just waiting to get a chance to head over and use my GameStop credit. And so I grabbed it. I've only used it to make one thing, which was grilled salmon, which I kind of knew how to make anyway, but I figured that's what I was going to have anyway. So I was like, well, I might as well turn the game on and see what it says to do. And that turned out great. Actually, what I've been doing so far is just I was watching a lot of TV and movies this week, and I would turn on America's Test Kitchen and just go through the list of recipes, because there's 300 of them. I mean, there's so many. It's more than twice as many as you had in Personal Trainer Cooking. And so I just went through the recipes and just marked the ones. You have there's like a try it button where you can kind of set it aside for one that you want to go back to. You can bookmark it, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I just went through every recipe in the game and bookmarked all the ones that seemed interesting. And out of 300, I'd marked over 50 that I wanted to go back and try sometime. So that's pretty good for a first swath, especially. And some of them that I didn't mark were just things that I already know how to make. So I didn't really feel the need to check up on them later, but they still might come in handy. And really the only thing I wanted to say about America's Test Kitchen, I mean, it is basically the same thing as Personal Trainer Cooking, just with more recipes. I guess there was some question early on as to whether the recipes were inclusive of the previous game, and so they've just added more on it, like an expansion pack or something. And also, is it really all American food? Because that was my big complaint about Personal Trainer Cooking, is that it's great if you're interested in, you know, learning to make a lot of diverse European food, a lot of Asian food, like tons of Japanese and Chinese recipes, and really very little outside of those two continents. There was very, very little to choose from on the North American continent or South American or African. Africa wasn't even on the map in Personal Trainer Cooking. So I was like, man, there's a lot of good food in Africa. I'd like to learn how to make some of it, but not happening. So the great thing about America's Test Kitchen is it does focus on American food, and we have a great diversity, you know, here because of the whole melting pot and everything, and a lot of regional cuisines, etc. And so I'm pretty glad that they did this, because I feel like it's bringing out, there's a lot of things that I wanted to learn to cook that aren't super exotic, but they're things that I don't know how to make yet. You know, they're things from around here. And so I'm looking forward to learning how to do all that stuff. But the nice thing is there are still some foreign recipes, but they're things that you would get in America. Stuff like teriyaki chicken, homemade tacos, you know, things like this. That there's even a couple of French desserts. I mean, it's nothing – it's definitely not nearly as foreign-centric as the previous game was. But it's nice that it's not all fried chicken and beans, you know. Like it's there's actually a really nice variety to the selection. I mean, with 300 recipes, there would have to be, right?
Yeah. So there's 10 different ways to make a hot dog, a chili dog.
There are
10
different ways to make a hot dog. To be clear, John, don't step, son.
I don't think there's a recipe for hot dogs, but there is definitely one for hamburgers.
Is there one for poutine?
No, actually, no
sane person eats that.
I bet
John.
Quebec isn't even on the map.
Well, no, I mean it says America, but it's really the United States, right? But I mean, yeah, Canada doesn't have a whole lot of its own cuisine, but poutine is the one Canadian food, right? And I love poutine. I have this fascination with poutine.
You're a good man, Johnny.
That sounds dirty, and I hope Greg isolates that and just plays it at the end over and over.
Don't give me ideas.
If anyone doesn't know, poutine is basically French fries with gravy and cheese curds.
Oh,
I mean,
so
how can you not like that?
It's so good.
Yeah, it's comfort food.
Yeah, it really
which
is.
Which is to say it's really, really fucking bad for you.
Yeah, it's drunk person's food completely.
Pretty much anything with gravy I'm down with,
you know?
So anyway, yeah, I'm pretty happy with it. For $20, I think it's a very impressive set of recipes, and it really corrects the number one deficiency of the previous game. Other than the selection of recipes, it's almost indistinguishable from Personal Trainer Cooking. I mean, it's the same voice, the same interface. There's a couple of new features, like you can, for really simple recipes, you can send a copy of it to someone else's DS, And I think that's for when you have a group cooking and you want to see the instructions on multiple screens, but it doesn't seem that useful. The only other difference, and I guess this comes in because the recipes come from America's Test Kitchen, when you're choosing recipes, there's a little arrow up in the corner that lets you flip between these pages of notes on the top screen. So before you even start the recipe, you can read all these notes they have on how to prepare it. And the notes in this game are far more extensive than they were in the previous game. America's Test Kitchen, some of its, you know, some of the notes boil down to, well, we wondered, can you make barbecue chicken indoors without all the smoke? Well, we tried 50 different ways to do it and finally found this surprising method where you use a can of beer or whatever, you know. So it's really actually fun to read through all that. And for some of the recipes, I think it's going to give you a lot more explicit detail about the methodology of how to do it and why the recipe is set up that way. And a lot of that detail was lacking in the previous game. So I like it a lot. I'm looking forward to actually cooking a lot of different stuff with it. That's all from me, and James is going to wrap up new business.
So we call that Blue Ocean World Report?
Yeah.
And now to our RPG correspondent, James Jones.
So I mentioned that something didn't feel right about the add-on to Dragon Age Origins last week. I felt like something was very wrong here, and something bad was about to happen. And it did. The game ended at 9.5 hours, which the PR for the Dragon Age Origins Awakening bills it as adding 20 hours of gameplay, which could only accomplish if you're blind and don't know where you're going, or they're lying.
Yeah, you should never trust those estimates of how many hours it takes.
Like, I could have taken a nap in the middle of the game every sitting and not reached 20 hours. So it's 9.5 hours for $40. So
is that is that really a problem? A lot of games are 60 bucks for 9.5 hours.
It's totally a problem in this game.
Yeah, it's absolutely different. It's different though because it's more of an extensive kind of experience RPG. You know, what I mean, if it's Sin and Punishment and it lasts that long, it's a long time. It's a completely different kind of gameplay. But, you know, it's an intensive experience.
And it just feels like the entire story arc is jammed into this really short time frame, where they basically said, we're going to introduce a whole new concept of what is going on with the enemies that you thought you had beaten in the main game, but we're going to try to jam all of the development of these enemies into 9.5 hours, including their death.
So rushed.
Yeah. Rushed. There's no flow. It feels... And they basically introduced 13 characters or something like that to basically give you a new cast in 9.5 hours, whereas you might have gone 4 or 5 hours in the main game just getting to know a character before they dropped a new one on you. Yeah. So it's just, I don't know. It just doesn't work.
You're not recommending it.
No, definitely not. It is in no way worth $40, which I'm glad I didn't pay $40.
Or even $20 from the sounds of it.
20 is pushing it. Yeah, it really is.
You don't sound all that happy about even your 20 on it.
Yeah, 20 was pushing it. I mean, it was fine for what it was. It just wasn't good.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't meet the expectations that it should have easily met. So after that, I moved on to my next RPG, which I hope to God to be done with soon, because it's Shin Megami Tensei: Strange Journey,
which is kind of James Jones's life, actually.
The first word of the subtitle completely defines this game. Because honestly, I am about 11 hours in, and I have no clue what the hell is going on. The Earth is being swallowed from the South Pole out with an expanding parallel universe that consumes everything in it, called the Schwarzwelt, that you are sent to investigate what it is and make it stop expanding and get stuck in there.
It sounds like you have a pretty good grasp on it to me.
And it's full of demons that say things that make no sense. Like, this is the game. And apparently I'm supposed to kill the demons, but instead you recruit some of them into your party by talking to them.
Yeah, I've heard some people compare it to Pokemon. I mean,
You're high, yes, exactly like Pokemon.
I was wondering, I was always adding a bit. So it's like a first-person dungeon crawler. But
yeah,
it's
very much like the old Phantasy Star games. It's... You move one square at a time in a first-person mode. You turn like a tank.
Mm.
Well, let's get to the demons, because that's kind of the meat of the game as such. You basically can fight them when you encounter them or recruit them. And to recruit them, you talk to them, which is an option. And you engage them in some kind of witty repartee, which is basically just luck. Like, I had a demon ask me, you're wearing this armor that's part computer, part bio-enhancement called the Demonica. And the monster asks you, you know, the last time I saw a human was a long time ago, but they didn't wear clothes like that. What's with that? And your choices are, it's functional, it's stylish, or it's manly. I picked it's functional. And she goes, oh, so you don't care about fashion at all. You need to die. And then she attacked me. I was like, what?
Okay. Demon fashionistas. There
well,
you go.
My personal favorite, though, was this demon of a child, a girl. But she's really freaky looking. And I talked to her, and she said, I'm not a human girl, you know. I'm a demon. Why aren't you afraid? And your choices are, I'm not afraid, I am afraid, or no, you are a girl. And I picked, no, you are a girl. And she goes, yeah, my mom always told me girls should be graceful. I'm glad you could tell.
What?
I have no idea what's going on.
No rhyme or reason to it.
So, but yeah, there's almost no rhyme or reason as to how you win these conversations with them. So it's like, well, so you could talk to two of the same demon, and even if you get the same questions, which you won't, the same answer will yield different results. So it's like, did you get lucky and then maybe get to recruit this guy? Oh, you could have.
Yeah.
And then you get to combine them to try to make them stronger. But once again, there's no rhyme or reason as to how you combine to what you end up with, as near as I can tell.
So what's the, other than the chatting with demons, what's the battle system like? Is it good?
It's a turn-based battle. So basically you can do physical attacks or magic. And some magic is, you know, area effect. Some's not. You know, it's your standard turn-based battle system. And the problem is that when I got to the first boss, which is all I've beaten so far, I had already gone through the dungeon 3 or 4 times on other missions. This is like my 4th time in the dungeon. He still kicked my ass, so it took me a few times to beat him. But then you go to the next dungeon, and it's exactly the same. And there's like 6 of them, and I have no desire to play through 6 of them because I'll go insane.
So you'll definitely be doing that for the next 6 weeks.
200 hours later.
No. Yeah. God, no.
Now, James, I guess my question is, why did you play Pokemon Mystery Dungeon for dozens of hours, and yet you feel like you're not going to make it through Strange Journey?
Because, if you'll recall at the time when I was discussing Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, it was just the whole level system I hated. The rest of the game, I generally speaking, liked. Look, it just happens
is
that
the game we spent 2 years shitting on.
Yeah, that's not the way I recall
That's a little bit of revisionist history if I've ever heard it.
Flavor of the conversation.
I basically said that playing the game was really painful, but I generally liked the story.
Ubisoft, James generally likes them.
Shut up, John.
That's what we've learned today.
But because if you go back to the review, I actually praised the game's story, the game's sound, and the game's animated sequences, and then I say, the gameplay would be fine if there was less of it.
I remember that you liked
it. Whereas Strange Journey, it's just like me constantly going, what the fuck are you talking about?
You weren't bemused by Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, is that your point?
At least in Mystery Dungeon, I knew what I had to do. Even though what I had to do seemed insurmountable, in Strange Journey, it's like, fuck it, we'll just do something. maybe I'll run into a story boss somewhere. It could happen.
I think I sympathize with you, James, because I'm sure we're all familiar with the famous anime movie Akira. I've never made it through Akira without falling asleep.
It gets pretty slow.
Which is weird because, I mean, it's certainly not an uninteresting movie, but it's so confusing. I mean, it's been a while since I tried to watch it, but I know every time I've tried to watch it, I get so confused that I lose interest, and when I lose interest in a movie, it's sleepy time, or walk away time, because I can't just sit there and be bombarded by random shit, or what seems like random shit. So, it sounds like that's a bit of what you're going through with this Mega Ten game.
Yeah, it's so just like, hey, and now we're in a different level, and this level looks like a city being bombed by giant biplanes. What? and then the characters point out, it's been a long time since biplanes have dropped bombs like that. I'm like, no, really? I haven't noticed.
Do any of your characters ever say, wow, this is a really strange journey?
Oh, no.
They might have, but I might have been too busy going, what? What's wrong with you people?
Well, you said you like the graphics and the music in Pokemon. What do you think of them on this? I've heard it's a fairly impressive DS game.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's very, very colorful, which I guess makes sense. The music is okay. that they included a soundtrack with the game, which I think may have been a little bit of wishful thinking on their part, that they created a soundtrack.
You're contractually obliged to do that for if you're Atlas, though.
I think you might be. I'm going through the Atlas DS games I've played. Yeah, they pretty much do that all the time now. But, you know, it's just the technical merits of the game. I mean, it's not going to shine on those alone. And the combat system's pretty dry. And it's basically Phantasy Star for the Genesis on acid. This game is.
So aside from the story, it would be a pretty run-of-the-mill RPG, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, the mechanic of you have to recruit... I mean, you don't have any party members except for your demons.
Oh, okay.
And that you have to recruit them, and you can blend them together to make new demons. I mean, that's kind of interesting, but it doesn't really make sense how I mix this demon with that demon and I get this. Mm-hmm. A lot of times you're like, I don't understand how he went from A to B to see.
And just the fact that securing them, their services, seems arbitrary.
It's highly arbitrary.
Something that seems so fundamental to your ability to fight, basically, if they're your party members, is a little curious.
Right, and sometimes they'll literally just come up and say, before the fight starts, say, hey, I'm really bored around here. I'm going to come with you. And then they just force themselves into your party. And then sometimes you're going to talk to them and they're like, no, it's the full moon. You have to die. What?
Sounds like a weird-ass game.
It is a very strange game.
Okay, James, did you want to say anything else before we go?
I will not be playing this game for 500 hours because, A, I have to do my DS XL review, which will be out before our DSi review.
That is our DSi review.
The combo pack, yeah. We were just waiting.
I'm just waiting to strike, James.
Uh-huh. You're just going to refuse to edit the DSi XL review until you get yours out there? Is that what it is?
Out of spite. You're right.
And I've procured my next game, which I will not go into too much yet, but it's the Soccer Wars 5, which would be the first one to come out in the U.S., weirdly. Mm-hmm. So that will prevent me from killing myself playing Strange Journey.
It's because it's a mech game, is it? Is it a mech game?
Kind of.
It's a mech dating sim.
Yeah, RPG, that's right. Turn-based strategy game.
So Long My Love, isn't that the subtitle?
Yes. Is it made by the Ace Combat team? That's my question.
No, okay.
It's made by Overworks, actually, the guys who made Skies of Arcadia and Valkyria Chronicles.
It's an internally developed Sega franchise that they've spun off into a bunch of other properties that's being published in the U.S. for the first time by NIS, who basically decided to fund a Wii port, because it's a PS2 game, that they then went to Overworks to develop, but without Sega's involvement, even though Overworks is kind of part of Sega.
Yeah.
It's so
a little
weird.
A bit of a complicated journey to America for the 1,000 people who are going to buy it. I've actually heard it's really good.
And see,
really
that's just
good.
It was on my radar, and then Johnny sent me an email, was it Monday? Basically saying, have you seen IGN's review of this game? This might be in your wheelhouse.
Yeah.
and I basically sat there on the cell phone and read IGN's review and went, damn it. Yeah. And then proceeded to use my Best Buy rewards points to order it from the phone.
From the phone. So you didn't even move. You're right then and there.
Desk at work.
I was just reading that article, and I wasn't sure if it had come out yet or when it was coming out. I remember hearing that Sakura Wars was coming out on Wii. And yeah, when I saw that review, I was like, I got to tell James, because this sounds, you know, right up his alley, and apparently it was.
Yeah, it's an entire game about character development.
Yeah. I mean, I'm slightly curious in it myself, although I'm really not in an RPG mood right now.
You know, it's funny because I kind of got in the RPG mood after playing, I don't even remember what game this whole kick started on.
I should go back and trace it from the podcast.
Someone
should make a chart of James's of James's mood, and the x-axis isn't time, it's the RPG that he's currently playing.
It probably was The Last Remnant, but I lost that and then moved to Tales of Symphonia, Dawn of the New World.
Well, I think the whole thing with your Xbox just kind of made that whole thing like just sort of forbidden fruit, right? Because you couldn't play it. You had no option to play it.
If we have successfully pinpointed this, then when I inevitably event time travel, then I can use it to correct all of this.
So you could go back and take your Xbox out of that cabinet. Just trust me on this one.
Greg, all you have to do is go smash your head on a toilet.
Yeah, and then the flux capacitor will come
right
to my mind.
Oh,
don't test my 80s movie knowledge, Johnny.
So anyway...
Yeah, that's new business.
More RPGs coming. That is new business. Boy, that's a lot of new business. And now we're going to take a much-needed break, and when we come back, we have some really good listener mail. Chunky.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
All right, well, first up this week, 2009, the games we loved. I don't know why I'm talking about this. James did all the
Seriously,
work.
Seriously, John, what the hell?
It's the substitute for our 2009 Game of the Year Awards.
It's the improvement of the 2009 Game of the Year Awards.
We decided to do it a little bit different format that was a little more inclusive and less contentious, although still contentious. But anyway, it is a big list of our favorite games of last year. It's called The Games We Loved. It's a really good feature, actually. I think you'll like it a lot.
James did a great job on it.
Oh, my God!
All right, Zach reviews Cave Story, which he says some of the boss battles are quite difficult, but old school game fans will love this game and its retro design, graphics, and music.
Yes, they will.
Looking forward to it one day.
So Andy's got a blog about America's Test Kitchen, which Johnny's already told us about this blog and the video blog that he posted making stir fry.
James apparently hasn't watched this. It's a really good video Andy put together. It's got music, it's got Andy talking, it's got him cooking, it's all spliced together very professionally. It's really good. Especially if you don't have experience with personal trainer cooking and you want to see what the software is like, it's very, very good introduction to it.
All right, and of course we have NWR Newscast number 15, the regular crew, along with special guest Grant Buell. They talk a lot about Cave Story, and they also talk about the roster of NBA Jam, Sega dissing Mad World, and the Wii, and all Nintendo fans in general, and probably everybody's mom on this podcast, and our recent DSiWare feature. So check that out. It's always enjoyable.
Okay, thanks everybody. That is what's going on at NintendoWorldReport.com this week, so check it out, man. Right, we interrupt your regularly scheduled football talk for part two of Radio Free Nintendo. It's time for listener mail, and John is up first.
All right, Chad writes, over the last month or so, you've all made references to games like Dragon's Lair, Sewer Shark, and Heavy Rain. That got me thinking about an old PC game that came out in 1993, The Seventh Guest. Have any of you ever played The Seventh Guest? Now that I think about it, The Seventh Guest was just an adult, horror-themed version of Professor Layton. And it predates Professor Layton by 14 years. It might just be the nostalgia talking, but I would like to see an attempt at a game that uses real footage of real actors, or yet another attempt at a game that uses real footage of real actors. I don't want to see every game use it, and I know there are plenty of bad examples of its use, but I still think it can be done right. Maybe in another Seventh Guest type game. What do you guys think?
Have any of us played The Seventh Guest?
I've never played The Seventh Guest.
Long, long, long time ago.
I knew of it. I think I might have had a demo for it at one point.
It's been so long that I just remember that it was just like, what in the hell is this?
It's a bit like Myst, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. To be fair, there was a game like this made later, The 11th Hour, which was a sequel.
It's a sequel, yeah.
Yeah. So technically, his letters already happened.
Yeah. and with Professor Layton.
There you go.
You know, there's a bunch more of those to potentially come to England.
I guess it's interesting how, you know, you get into the point there where there's a lot more performance capture stuff, you know, using actors in games, but, mm-hmm. you know...
And in movies, like with Avatar.
And in movies too, yeah. But, you know, in order to create performances, but it is still very much, you know, like Heavy Rain or whatever, still going to be within the context of sort of in-game graphics rather than footage that does it. I think it never feels like a really seamless interactive experience.
Yeah,
as much more slick as you could do it today than obviously the really crude stuff, you know, that went on in the mid-90s or whatever.
Yeah, but the problem is now we're also more refined with the graphics being more refined.
Yeah, so. Exactly. The bar's much higher. And also, so, there's always going to be the question of, you know, why, you know, what is this really giving you as an interactive experience?
The opportunity to experience bad acting.
Well, yeah. there are several games that still use full motion video live action footage of actors. I'm thinking Command & Conquer series. I think all of those games, including Red Alert.
They do it now, though, because it is cheesy. And they're like, yep, this is cheesy. This is our history.
Certainly in some cases, yeah.
The Need for Speed series has lately had kind of a penchant for this. I think mostly the Need for Speed Underground 1 and 2, and maybe Most Wanted or whatever that one was. But I know some of the this generation of Need for Speed games have had that. Then you've got Metal Gear Solid. All of those have some live action stuff to, you know, in various capacities, but 4 especially has some very strange stuff up front in the intro. There's like some fake TV shows and weird, really funny, weird stuff.
Fake commercials and stuff, yeah.
Target Terror uses live action.
Explosion Man has some stuff at the end. I don't want to...
Mad Dog McGee.
McCree.
Excuse me.
Mad Dog McGee is a...
Pardon you, sir.
Oh, no. God forbid I get that classic's name wrong.
Yeah, that's not a modern game, really.
It's on Wii.
That's all that matters.
Yeah. It's
next generation, buddy.
Yeah, there's the... I guess, you know, Target Terror and all that stuff counts, but...
Technically. On an extreme technicality.
Chris Kohler approved collector's items of the future.
Pretty much. But yeah, I mean, it's not totally gone, but it's not happening as prominently as it was back in the Wing Commander Mist. Thank God.
Well, yeah, at that time they were trying to replace poor graphics with full motion video.
That. I'm trying to think of another one. The Star Wars... There was a bunch of Star Wars games that did it, too.
Yeah, I remember playing one on...
Rebel something.
Rebel Assault. I played it on PlayStation 1.
It's Rebel Assault 2, because the first Rebel Assault didn't... And then they had to go back and cast people that looked like the characters they drew in the first game. And none of them could act. I remember having this... But they were aware of the fact that none of them could act. So there were all these codes to basically get these Easter egg versions of the dialogue and stuff where Vader would talk about, like, how he has a headache and just crazy shit like that. It was so good.
What the hell?
The old LucasArts game were just full of these fucking Easter eggs. It was great.
Yeah. Rebel Assault 2 is horrible. I've played it.
It is
absolutely
Rebel Assault 2,
horrible.
The Hidden Empire. It's
moving a cursor around over FMV.
So it's like Sewer Shark, then?
Yeah, it is basically Sewer Shark.
Can we make an entire game you can control with a mouse or a joystick, but it's all FMV? And the answer is no, but they published it anyway.
Yeah. So, I don't know if we answered all the questions there, but actually, one more thing I'll say about The Seventh Guest. If you're interested in that classic PC, really one of the first CD-ROM games, along with Myst, there is a feature coming up called Reset Button, and there will be an interview with a guy who worked on The Seventh Guest, among other things. He also worked on Silver Surfer for NES and a ton
that
of other
bastard.
Crazy shit. He's had a wild career, so look out for that probably next week. I think you'll be very interested in that. Okay, so Greg has the next letter.
Rob in Delaware, Ohio writes, "As I get older, I find myself having less time to dedicate to games. When I actually get to play, I just want to be able to enjoy them without the aggravation of hitting dead ends I can't get past, be it particularly difficult bosses or just some precise act I can't perform quite right. With the imminent arrival of Metroid Other M, I find myself hoping for a difficulty selection option. I love being able to experience Arkham Asylum with very little pressure on easy. Although I didn't need to use it, I felt much more secure knowing the Super Guide was waiting for me in New Super Mario Bros. Wii. Conversely, I never even got to finish Twilight Princess because I couldn't get past the annoying horseback escort mission. Do you think Metroid Other M will have various difficulty options? Do you think this is even a good idea in general? Does your opinion change if the game in question isn't a quote-unquote hardcore title? Also, does the advent of the Super Guide, which is simply a different form of selecting your difficulty in a sense, change anything?"
Well, wow. As for the question of whether Other M will have multiple difficulty selections, I mean, Nintendo games usually don't, right?
But recent Metroids have tended to have them.
Well, yeah, the Prime games developed in America, they did have them. And Ninja Gaiden has difficulty settings.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Certainly,
Team Ninja has an experience.
But, I mean, even Zero Mission had easy and normal, and then an unlockable hard. And I believe
did it have easy?
It did.
Okay.
I know, it's hard to believe. It wasn't normal easy enough, but in fact...
Yeah, I know. That's not a hard game.
It did have an easy option. I also believe they added an easy option into the Japanese version of Metroid Fusion, which could be telling, because the book on Other M, to some extent, is that it is an attempt to reach out to the Japanese market with Metroid. So I don't know whether... that tells us anything in terms of that they would want to have an easy option in there, possibly to make sure that if there's a perception in the Japanese market that Metroid is something that's intimidating, they might want to make sure that's not felt.
Yeah, but Team Ninja makes, I mean, traditionally, yeah, well, they make very, very difficult games.
Yeah, well, that could be another thing that might intimidate people, so that's why they may want to put that easy option out in front, you know, right there, make it explicit to people that they don't have to play it, you know, on a specific difficulty. They could tailor it to their own needs.
Well, they may very well. I mean, we don't know yet. It's just just the kind of detail that you're not going to get this early on, but it seems quite feasible that it might have difficulty options. I guess then the next question is, do we have a problem with that?
No.
Does that dilute the experience?
No, in fact, anybody who does have a problem with a game having a difficulty setting is an asshole. I'm serious. There's no reason that you should be upset about a game having difficulty settings. There is literally no reason to do it unless you're being an elitist douche.
Well, I do think there are certain games that don't need it. I mean, if it was there, it wouldn't hurt it.
It is impossible for a game to be hurt by having difficulty settings.
Unless it's not balanced well.
Perhaps you could consider some convoluted hypothetical scenario where somehow they're concerned about difficulty settings and puts them into some corner where they come up with a bunch of silly solutions which ultimately kind of don't balance the game out well. But it just doesn't seem...
That's not the fact that there is difficulty settings is the problem. It's the fact they're not done well.
Well, yeah, that's true, I suppose, but I don't know whether some people might have some suspicion
Presence of difficulty settings in no way affects the game's
quality. No, it should. I don't see a downside to it. I really don't. And certainly, as you see now, gamers that you know started gaming back on the NES or whatever, they're getting older, they've got less time, or you know the people that are the new entrants into the market that are being reached out to with Wii and DS. You know, sometimes it's not so much going to be a matter of, you know, can I do this at all, but it's like,
but will,
you know, can I spend the amount of time that it would take to develop the level of mastery to do it like this.
Well, you know,
so, I mean, I completely sympathise with Rob's position from the point of view that, as he was saying, kind of, you know, like with Arkham Asylum, but, you know, just put it on easy and don't worry about it. You know, I can understand that. I mean, I played through Arkham Asylum on normal. I thought it was fine, but either way, why not have the option?
Well, you know, one thing that the Dragon Age game does and the Mass Effect games do is that they let you be able to dynamically change your difficulty setting.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
So what I ran into was a boss that, yeah, I probably could have beaten it if I kept pounding on him long enough, but I was just like, you know, I'd lost to him 3 times and it was really close every time. I don't want to sit through it again. Let's just go to easy real quick, take him out, and then go back up.
That's almost like the Super Guide.
God of War.
It is very much like the Super Guide.
The early God of War started doing that. Like, after you would die 3 times in the same area, they would start asking you, almost making fun of you in a way. Do you want to move down?
There's no pressure about this. It just tells you, you know, you can change this dynamically if you want to.
Yeah, I see. I definitely like the idea to have the dynamic change of difficulty because, I mean, I actually came across this, you know, kind of almost feeling like I wished it had in Darksiders, because I had certainly read and heard things about Darksiders, and basically the combat was just too easy on the normal setting, you know, that it kind of just devolved into pure button mashery.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, you know, the hardest setting is unlockable from the start, so I thought, oh, I'll play it on the hardest setting. And the thing is that there were a few occasions where it's like, ugh.
It's just too brutal.
If I could just dial this down and dial it back up again, I would have been quite grateful for that. And yeah, it wasn't a big deal, I just persisted with it anyway, but that was one case where I perceived, like, yeah, that feature would be interesting. And the thing is, it would actually perhaps encourage people more to try the more difficult settings because they're not locked into a path. If they, if they get so many hours and it's like too hard, they could bail out.
Well, and also it goes the other way too, where if like, God, this game is really easy.
Yeah, you could dial it up.
One problem I have with difficulty levels is that they always ask you at the right up front before, you know, as you're starting the game, they ask you, do you want to play it on easy, normal, or hard? And I'm like, well, I don't know. I haven't played it before.
Normal. I'm a normal gamer. I'll play it on normal.
I go with normal, but maybe that's too... The problem is these levels don't mean anything. They're relative to the particular game.
Right.
And if you haven't played the game before... then you don't really have a point of reference, you know?
There are some kind of sort of forays into trying to give more context. You know, certainly Killzone 2, you know, it kind of says you have some first-person shooter experience or like you regularly play shooters and things like that. And then, of course, there was the Madden thing they did.
I was going to bring that up.
Football IQ thing that with like experiment where you boot up the game and it kind of does like a diagnostic on you, essentially, to kind of tailor the experience from there, which is an interesting idea that could certainly be applied to other genres.
Yep. If you get a perfect score, did you get to replace Madden next to Al Michaels?
Yeah, that's like Chris Collinsworth got the job.
That would explain everything.
I feel like a good way to do it would be, you know, like maybe in a traditional action adventure type game, is to give you a brief section to play through before you choose the difficulty. And maybe it's something that everybody's going to get through one way or another, but maybe there are multiple different outcomes based on how you play it, how you tackle it. I'm thinking of maybe even like a platformer where you get to the hard mode by, you know, the first level, you just beat it in a different way. I mean, this is actually goes back to almost like Star Fox 64 kind of progression where the hard levels, you just have to play better to get to them. So it's not like you just
Left 4 Dead actually makes the game harder as depending on how you perform, I think. I'm pretty sure Left 4 Dead's AI works that way.
Yeah, dynamic, difficult. I mean, these are topics.
I like it to be upfront.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly broached a lot of these topics. I believe it was episode 167.
God damn!
Billy came on the show and we did a feature on difficulty, so if Rob hasn't heard that one, certainly I would recommend he goes back and hear some of our thoughts on dynamic difficulty and all that sort of thing. But, I mean, the super guide part, in terms of what does it change or anything, well... I was in the same boat as Rob. I didn't use it. Having played through the entire game where we talked about the super guide in that episode, it was kind of a hypothetical at that point. So it hasn't changed anything for me yet. I mean, I guess the more interesting thing is going to be where it gets implemented into things that are less straightforward than Mario.
What if Other M had a super guide? How would we feel
it's
about
not
that?
Unfathomable considering this sort of the Japan stuff that I was mentioning. But Zelda, of course, is the thing that we think about because the patents had the allusions to Zelda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I mean, as you mentioned, Johnny, you know, like with the whole like going to GameFAQs stuff, you know, it's just kind of integrating that into the game for people. And I think it could certainly be a convenience. I guess the question is whether, you know, some will feel that the incentives and the structure of it are set up in such a way that maybe people would be too quick to use it. I mean, I guess the question is, what would be the Zelda equivalent of dying 8 times?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Pushing around blocks for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, the puzzle in Twilight Princess, the puzzle where you have to do to get the Master Sword, where you're moving these statues around on a little grid and trying to get them... That I hated that puzzle. I mean, it's neat, but it's brutally difficult.
Well, some of it is those things made noises every time you moved them.
Yeah.
It's just made it, and they move quite slowly and stuff. You know, it wasn't very quick to tinker with, which is annoying.
You have to remember, I reviewed Twilight Princess before the game came out, and so I didn't have anywhere to turn to for help.
Right.
And, you know, I had other friends who were also reviewing the game, and we conferred every now and then on certain points, but that's the kind of thing where, unless you have like a step-by-step, there's really nothing anyone can tell you to help you get through that puzzle. It's a lot of trial and error, and it took me literally hours to get through that puzzle. I was like, oh my god, can I please go back to playing Zelda?
Yeah.
I'm done with this puzzle.
It does feel
I'm
very separate, doesn't it? It does. Yeah. It does feel like more of an adventure game puzzle.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean,
well, in that case, it'd be nice if you could just show the next step, just to get you going.
Yeah. A hint.
Well, and that's the kind of thing where a difficulty setting is not going to help you that much either, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's very true. Difficulty doesn't always make sense.
Exactly. I mean, like, when you're talking about difficulty settings, what we're normally talking about is, you know, damage and health calculations and, you know, maybe numbers of enemies and things like that. And those work really well in, like, first-person shooters or, like, Sin and Punishment or stuff like that. But I guess what the Super Guide, that kind of integrated kind of thing could change is it could sort of extend organic difficulty adjustments into genres where we haven't thought of them before. Yeah, into things like Zelda. You know, that I guess that's what it may change. And Nintendo are very fond of organic difficulty settings. Like the Metroid games are some of the, you know, to go back to the question about other previous Metroid games, you know, the more recent ones, I guess, are some of the only Nintendo games I can think of with explicit difficulty settings. You know, normally it is stuff like with Star Fox, where it's like, oh, well, it's different routes. Or like, you know, with Mario, it's, well, you know, if you want to get all the stars, it's harder. And, you know, they don't normally just stratify it into tags. And Metroid's one of the few series where they do. So I think perhaps the odds on there being explicit difficulty settings in Other M are actually, you know, pretty good on that basis.
Yeah. Okay, we got to move on, but that was a great question, and like Greg said, you might want to check up on our previous episode, apparently number 167, for further discussion on the topic. And now we move on, and the next question is from Maddie B. in British Columbia. Is anyone planning on bringing out a more robust dance program or step dancing program that uses the Wii Fit balance board? I'd really like an exercise option that uses more music to do leg and full body work. I'm getting pretty tired of the step exercise program on Wii Fit Plus. And I should mention, the title of Maddie B's email was Just Dance, although he didn't explicitly refer to it in the question.
I mean, is there going to be anything in the upcoming EA Sports Active? Because EA, they are making another.
They are, yes. I don't know if 2.0 is going to have... They haven't said a whole lot about what's going to be in that, so it's possible. Just Dance, I don't think that's what you're looking for.
No, you're not.
I'm not super familiar with the details on Just Dance. A couple million other people are, but...
Yeah, it's a huge hit.
I don't think it uses the balance board.
No, it just makes you look like a moron in a really, really, really lame fedora.
I would say, Maddie, you should check out Dance Dance Revolution.
There's a new one coming out, isn't there?
There's always a new one coming out.
Another hottest party, whatever.
But they're all good. I mean, you know, take your pick. Whatever's the cheapest, most convenient one for you to grab. Dance Dance Revolution is very good. There's a reason it's been around for a long time and a lot of people like it. It's a lot of fun. The music is not necessarily my or your cup of tea, but it is real music. It's certainly far more than the elevator shit you get in Wii Fit. So, you know, it is dance music, and you're kind of dancing to it. Or as my mom likes to say, jumping around. She's like, that's not dancing, that's jumping around. You look like you're marching and jumping.
Yeah, I would have, in some ways, I'm kind of surprised the balance board hasn't been bigger in terms of things that actually use that, you know, considering how many balance board owners there are out there.
I don't think the balance board is really a good device for dancing.
No, because it really just detects force. If there's not.
Yeah, it's not really made for that. That's not what it's for. And I guess one final thing I'd say about the whole Wii Fit thing is I use the step program quite a bit in Wii Fit Plus, but I don't watch it. There's a thing called Free Step in the aerobics tab, and this is in the original Wii Fit as well. And you turn that on, you can run it for up to 30 minutes, and it calls out the beat. It taps out the beat on your Wii remote speaker. One of the best uses of it I've seen. So the beat taps out on the speaker, and the game literally tells you, now you can do it while you watch TV. So the idea is that you would switch your inputs or whatever, and now you can do up to 30 minutes of step workout, but you can do it while watching a movie or watching a TV show, and I do that all the time. Or put on your own music, you know? I mean, the beat may not match up, but... Or put on a podcast. I mean, I play games all the time with podcasts on.
March to us.
If I'm not interested in the music or whatever. So I would say, you know, treat it like any other kind of exercising, in that if you're interested in doing the step exercise thing, you can do that while you do other things. But as far as a dance game, you know, I don't want to impugn Just Dance. I haven't played it. It doesn't sound all that appealing to me, but DDR is a good option. Very good option.
Could Muscle March scratch this itch in any way?
No.
Yes. Oh, there's plenty of itches Muscle March can scratch.
No. Muscle March is not a dance game. Although, I think it's about as much of a dance game as Just Dance. I mean,
no.
But it is. I mean, you know, there's that WiiWare game called Helix that is very much Muscle March, basically. I mean,
but
you're
much,
just kind of waving your arms
exciting.
Around in different positions. So there's that too. I mean, if you want to try the WiiWare game, I think it's only like $10. So it's a
Muscle March is way cheaper than that.
Yeah, Muscle March is $5, but James is pulling your leg.
You had to use that one with Muscle March, didn't you?
Pulling your leg.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, James, you have the last question.
Tanuki141 writes, okay, I have three questions for you guys.
Oh, three. Damn.
First of all, what do you guys think will happen with DSi exclusive games now that 3DS is coming soon? Is it just another option that Nintendo provides but will not actually get used? Second, it would be interesting if you went over the various first and second party developers for Nintendo and what you speculate they are working on in regards to the Wii and maybe even the 3DS. Lastly, I thought it would be neat if you had a segment where you analyzed the new Mario and Metroid gameplay trailers that were released recently. Thanks for your time and the podcast, which I have been listening to for almost a year now.
Okay, thanks for the question, Tanuki. Thanks for listening. So let's start with the top. DSi exclusive games.
The writing was on the wall from the start. The fact that they weren't DSi exclusive retail games from Nintendo out of the gate foreshadowed the fact that, you know, the real successor was not too far down the horizon, but some way down, and that, you know, this was not something that they were going to prohibit. The idea of an exclusive retail game for DSi, but basically exclusive content was going to be downloadable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the thing. There are a lot of exclusive DSi games. They're called DSiWare. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. That was the exclusive content arena, and then when they break from the DS in the retail space, it will be for something more substantively different, which we now know is the 3DS.
To be perfectly honest, most of the DSiWare games are not exclusive. They're cell phone ports or they're iPhone ports.
Or they're breakdowns of bigger games.
Certainly the non-Nintendo published content.
Or their clocks.
But there's all the art style stuff.
Yeah, the art style stuff is really cool.
All the stuff with Cube games that Nintendo's also joined up with them on. And there are others, but yeah, certainly there's a lot of overlap these days with the iPhone and all that.
Yeah, the DSi exclusive games, I mean, if 3DS has cameras on it, I guess it'll probably be fine. I mean, most DSi exclusive games are leveraged on their camera. So
let me say, if 3DS has cameras, they need to be much better cameras.
Well, yes, obviously. But, I mean, that's what all the DSi exclusive games are, usually. It's got some weird camera functionality.
The other thing would be taking advantage of the additional RAM or whatever, which I guess Korg DS10 Plus does or whatever.
I guess.
But other than that, you know, that's the thing. It's not enough of an upgrade in those areas, you know, if it's not the camera stuff, right, to make it worth your while cutting yourself off from the enormous DS user base that's separate from DSi. And if Nintendo isn't going to, you know, blaze the trail and make software that people are going to say, I have to get a DSi for, no one else is going to do it for them.
Right. I mean, nobody cares about the DSi selling except Nintendo.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the second part, let's actually skip to the third question here and talk briefly about the Mario and Metroid Other M, Mario Galaxy 2 and Metroid Other M trailers that were released recently. And we're not going to do like a play-by-play, but I'm sure we all watched them and have some thoughts on them. So who wants to go first here?
I think Metroid was certainly the far more interesting one because we hadn't really seen extended gameplay footage before.
Technically, we hadn't seen any gameplay
footage. Some of it was like maybe kind of, you know, but it's all very unclear because it's all mixed together with all sorts of CG stuff. And, you know, you didn't really know
what
you were
looking
at. Now you've got a much clearer idea, and I think the big takeaway from the Metroid Other M was the speed of the game.
Yeah. You know,
the Samus is scorching through these areas. If you cast your mind back to when I talked about Zero Mission for the Games of the Decade thing, one of the things I absolutely adore about that game is the pace of it. And it's certainly something that is not captured by the Prime games. It's one aspect of Metroid.
Quite a contrast between Prime and Other M.
Yeah, that sense of, you know, being this blistering sort of fast character was not captured in Prime for obvious reasons, and you know, they didn't really lessen how wonderful it was to a great degree. But I like to see that is something that hasn't been sort of captured in a console Metroid post Super Metroid before. So that's what I was encouraged by. The sort of flip side is, you know, we've got this all this sort of auto targeting and you're just shooting enemies. Like, how much is the combat going to be something interesting, or is it just going to be kind of perfunctory button mashing along the way? That would be my question that arose from that trailer.
Yeah, it's not too clear whether or not it's going to be just kind of repetitive, like auto lock, shoot, auto lock, shoot, auto lock, shoot, all the way through.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think of what I want to say about, because I mean, I have literally no expectations for Metroid.
James, do you think there's a potential for Other M to be like a Metroid game that you would like more than the previous ones?
If there's no backtracking. I mean,
that's one of the most interesting aspects we're still really unaware of is, you know, to what extent are we going to be dealing with one consistent world? Of course, the demo that was played at the media summit that Aaron got to do impressions of, he was on this bottle chip, you know, which kind of reeked of the first area of Metroid that's always, you know, like the pirate frigate or the space station at the start of Super Metroid, kind of. You know, so you might not expect that to be the one big world. And certainly we've seen like outdoor stuff and, you know, environments in this.
That was the best part of the trailer for me, was seeing that outdoor area.
It's pretty obvious. It's like you're going to go to that ship and then later on you're going to be on a planet. The question is it one big planet? Is it going to be, you know, the Super Metroid type of world, or, you know, something like in Metroid Prime even? Or, you know, could it be more level by level, more segmented like Prime 3? That has not been settled.
I expect there will be plenty of backtracking, although it may be a little more optional as it was in Fusion. Where in Fusion, you almost had to... The backtracking was almost like a secret bonus for, you know, like... It was hard to backtrack in that game because it was so segmented off. You know, you can only explore this area, now this area, and then eventually they start to connect together and open back up a little bit. But you didn't really need to backtrack in Fusion, and that's a big difference with all the other Metroid games where it's, you know, practically required. So it could very well be that Other M follows in that tradition of Fusion, and that, you know, it's, I don't know, I mean, Zero Mission, Sakamoto made that too, and that's more recent.
But yeah, there are other similarities with Fusion, so it'd be interesting to see if it's more similar in some of the gameplay structure as well. So that's the thing about what's so interesting about the Other M trailer is just that, you know, it's the first time that we're getting to answer some questions, but there's still so many more.
Well, it made me a lot more confident in Other M.
There was some encouraging things. So I like the speed. I like the environments that we were seeing. I like those very much. What remains something of a mystery for me, as I said, is these aspects of the combat. Not just like the shooting stuff, but also, like, you know, you've got this like melee stuff, you know, like these finishing moves and things.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, are they just going to be like cutscenes, you know, almost like the stuff I was saying in Darksiders, you know, you just press the same button every time to do a little finishing move? Or is there actually going to be more gameplay to melee combat, which would be a bit different for a Metroid game, certainly?
Yeah, I'm afraid that's an area where they might try to shoehorn in some motion controls.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, do you think it's going to be like a Shadow Complex where it kind of guides where you shoot at? Like, you don't really have much of a choice?
Actually, I think it's going to be simpler than Shadow Complex, because Shadow Complex has a lot of auto-aim, but you still aim. And in Other M, there's nowhere in the controls for you to aim.
Yeah.
So as far as we can tell, if you're facing the right direction, either left or right, and shoot, you will hit the enemy. And there's got to be more to it than that.
Yeah, well, the way you aim is in first person. I mean, that's a way you use missiles.
If you have to,
Yeah, but that's the real sort of thing. I mean, you're going to be like basically your sort of common cannon fodder enemies. You could just kind of sword to pass and press the fire button. It does everything for you. But then you face certain enemies that require missiles to kill them. And that's where the kind of aiming part's going to come in. It's still very difficult to pin down the rhythm of the game in that sense.
Right. So as far as Mario goes, I don't think the trailer really changed my...
It's Galaxy.
Yeah, it didn't really change my opinion or expectation. It did get me a little bit more excited just because it became a little more real, you know?
Yeah,
but there was nothing
tangible.
Surprising in that
trailer.
Shit
just got real, son.
There was new stuff, but, you know, it's like the kind of new stuff you sort of expect. It's like, oh, more sort of another thing for Yoshi. Like, you know, he lights up and it materializes all these platforms around him, or you've got the rock... ball, kind of rock Mario power up, and all this kind of thing. It's the kind of things you expect from Mario, which is, you know, almost anything and everything. But that's what you had in Galaxy.
Right.
I guess the biggest thing, perhaps, is just that it solidified the world map structure. Mm-hmm. And all that's always going to be more like overworld map from a 2D Mario this time, which we already really knew before the trailer, but yeah, this kind of shored it up and give us a little more idea of how that's going to work. But yeah, I mean, I think Galaxy 2 is largely a known quantity for many reasons, so it wasn't nearly quite so revelatory.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, what is there to... I mean, they basically came up right out and said, this is other levels for stuff that we didn't put in before. So it's the trailer basically confirms, yep, that's what it is.
And it still didn't show anything of the two-player co-op stuff, which may be a bit different. And there's some details beginning to emerge from Japan in terms of a website. It looks like you kind of, this time, you don't just play as a disembodied cursor if you're the sort of helper a second player, you actually play as one of those little Luma guys. I mean, they didn't show anything of that, you know, they were still playing that close to the vest, so it was kind of deliberately not particularly revealing trailer, but cool nonetheless, definitely, as Johnny said, you know, kind of solidified my anticipation for it, but it didn't do much more than that.
If they end up going with one of those little guys as a co-op character, I really have to question why not just do Luigi. I mean, I predicted a long time ago that you might actually be able to play as Mario and Luigi at the same time.
What I'm deducing from the website that I've seen is that it's still a pointer-only interaction. Hmm. That, you know, you are not controlling this character with an analog stick like the way the first player would be controlling Mario. But you have some sort of, you know, physical character on screen rather than just an abstract cursor. How much that changes the real... your meat of the gameplay interaction, we don't know yet.
Well, probably not a lot, seeing as how
they
turn it around.
So. But it's just interesting that they have kept this.
I just never felt like it added anything at all, period, in the
slightest. But you don't have a 4-year-old child, and we've heard from a lot of people who appreciated that feature.
I still think the main thing could be, you know, when he gets on Yoshi, because then maybe the one player controls what Yoshi could do, which is quite a lot with his tongue and stuff.
Right, but you wouldn't want to be able to control where you go, though, because then you would be stuck.
No, but the thing is that the analog stick will drive Yoshi, if you like, but then he could do so much stuff with his tongue that isn't trivial the way that collecting star bits is. So if they divvy it up between two players in that sense, that would be more meaningful.
Yeah, that would be.
Yeah, all I could think of is if you let them control Yoshi, you'd have that one friend who likes to drive you crazy by walking you into cliffs.
Black holes in this case.
I don't know what happened. It just kind of happened.
And obviously John has nothing to say about Galaxy 2.
Well, yeah, something to say. He said it already.
He does.
It's a family it's a family show.
Yeah.
Man!
He cannot wait to buy it and store it on a shelf.
No, actually, I like, like Rock Mario and all that kind of stuff. It looks certainly interesting, and I'm sure I'll pick it up at some point.
Yeah. But we at play is the pertinent point.
No, I mean, actually, I got to say that trailer certainly piqued my interest in it.
There you go. It must be a very good trailer. And now we go back to the second question, and I thought this was pretty interesting. So I kind of put out a partial list, I think it's a mostly complete list, of Nintendo development teams, and thought we would have a lightning round here where we go through and kind of throw out some ideas of either what we know that they're working on or what we think or hope that they might be working on. All right, so we'll start off with EAD, which is Nintendo's primary development house in Kyoto. They, you know, they make Zelda and
Mario.
They don't make Mario Galaxy, but in the past they've made
they do Super Mario Bros. Wii.
Yes,
that's true.
The entertainment analysis and development teams.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which there are like five of.
This is basically everything Miyamoto has his hands sort of directly involved in. So, what do we know that they're working on right now? Zelda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Pikmin, probably.
Pikmin, maybe. Right.
I mean, EAD is a huge portion of Nintendo's employees. It's like 500
it is, yeah.
people.
It's a very, very large. So, I mean, they're working on
because
a
they've
lot
absorbed,
of things.
They've absorbed like previously separate internal teams, like Sakamoto's, I think, was RD1 doesn't really exist anymore. It's been rolled into EAD.
Right.
They're probably working on some handheld stuff. Tezuka's probably leading up some kind of handheld
stuff. No, 3DS stuff. I mean, they've got to have some really significant things. I mean, it's possible.
So.
If they're not going to have a Star Fox on 3DS, then you may as well bury the franchise.
They're crazy.
Now.
Yeah.
It's over for Star Fox if there isn't one on 3DS. So it is possible that they could be, again, collaborating with Dylan Cuthbert
on a Star Fox
3DS game. I just think it makes a. Whether it means it'll happen is another thing, but I think it makes a hell of a lot of sense. And sometimes improbable things that do make a lot of sense happen, like with Sin and Punishment 2, is way more improbable than a Star Fox game on 3DS.
Yeah. Okay, so EAD Tokyo is the studio. It's only 5-6 years old studio, and that's where Galaxy 2 is being made.
Yeah.
So that's done, basically.
And EAD Tokyo technically falls under EAD's authority, but it's kind of like a special projects team out there on their own little
island.
Yeah,
it's separate, and it's managed separately in a lot of ways.
And their entire output is Jungle Beat and the Two Galaxies, right? That's it.
And Flipnote Studio.
Oh.
That's cool. So obviously we know what they're working on now. As far as what comes next, their next really big title will probably be for the next console, knowing the amount of time it takes to make something like a Galaxy game. And I don't know if there will be a Galaxy 3, or I don't even know if they'll make the next Mario game. Maybe that'll go back to EAD or something. But I would really like them to do like a short cycle project, like a sequel to Jungle Beat for Wii.
Yeah, that would be great.
I would really, really love that. And I think that's the kind of game that they can probably do in a much less time and with much less money than a Galaxy. You know, Jungle Beat, they did release the new Play Control version, which I don't know how good that is, but...
I mean, I imagine it's very much the same thing, but they just haven't got that tactile feedback of you actually pounding on those Congo drums, but... Yeah, the game's design is excellent. I mean, there's a novelty factor
to drumming along
to control the game and all that. And it was original. I mean, you got to give it that. But the fundamentals of the game are also just really good. The scoring system, the level design, etc.
Right.
So that's going to hold up, even if, you know, shaking the Wii remote and nunchuck around is a bit more flimsy.
Right. And you know, maybe it's not called Jungle Beat 2. Maybe it's just a new Donkey Kong. With some similarities, but I think they totally captured what Donkey Kong is all about. What's great about Jungle Beat is the rhythmic gameplay and the way the moves string together and you get these crazy combos. I mean, it's very arcadey in a way.
Oh, it is very, very much so.
In a sense, it could not be more different than Galaxy. And I feel like Galaxy is a bit too sprawling, or at least... It loses some of that tightness that Jungle Beat has because it has to be a bigger game.
I mean, it's a side-scrolling game and stuff, so I guess it's naturally more kind of condensed and things. But the real thing about it is the way the level design works on multiple levels, because there's just getting through the level the first time and all this stuff there is there kind of seems incidental. But then when you start to learn the intricacies of the scoring system and you see these patterns of bananas and these chains of bits of the environment that you can leap from one bit to the other and all that, it all sort of takes on a different meaning and you see the different layers to the level design. And that's what's really unique and brilliant about it. So something that, you know, perhaps you say that kind of multifaceted appeal would be good to see from them again.
So Intelligent Systems.
Yeah, Intelligent Systems. of course, they're behind... Yeah, I mean, we got to keep moving because we got a list here. But Intelligent Systems, they're the people behind Advanced Wars, Fire Emblem, some of the WarioWare.
They're probably making Advanced Wars or Fire Emblem for the 3DS.
Echo Shooter Plant 530, more important than anything.
I don't know what that is.
They're busy making Devil World while you're at it, right, John?
Yeah.
they're probably also, I mean, they did make Super Paper Mario.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they could be making something like that. I mean,
they made all the Paper Mario games.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
I can definitely see another Paper Mario game
happening. They did. I mean, they're probably working on a WarioWare DS game. Mm-hmm. I mean, they did Touch, DIY, and Snapped, apparently.
I'd like to see them do another Planet Puzzle League. That'd be great for 3DS. That'd be pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean,
that could happen.
And Twisted. I mean, they literally have the biggest range of things they could be doing right now.
Right.
I mean, because they could be making anything from Fire Emblem to WarioWare to a Mario Kart game. I mean, there's literally no thing they couldn't possibly be doing.
I think, actually, there's a lot of interesting potential for Paper Mario on 3DS. If you think about the aesthetic of that game, and especially going back to Super Paper Mario and the way it plays with perspective.
The thing when I've always thought about Paper Mario on handhelds before is it's kind of like, well, you know, Mario Luigi is kind of, you know, the domain of Mario RPGs on handhelds, but... Mm-hmm. Like you said, because it could be the unique kind of gimmick to exploit 3D, because, you know, Paper Mario's always had this, you know, like, was it Thousand Year Door had stuff with going into the background, and like they've always been a little bit toying with some of these things.
Right.
Then that could be the reason why you bring Paper Mario to the handhelds rather than just making another Mario and Luigi.
HAL Labs. Of course, these are the people behind the Kirby series.
And we know what they're making. I mean, everybody can just say what they're making
They've
right now.
They've been making that damn Kirby console game for yeah. forever.
It's still on the Japanese list.
You know what that game is? That game is basically just a big cover for whatever it is their next Smash Brothers game is.
Kirby Nukem Forever.
But they didn't make the last one.
I mean, Sora's not making it.
It seems like Nintendo thinks the principal ingredient in making a Smash Brothers is Sakurai. Not HAL. And Sakurai is now separate from HAL.
He's not going to make them forever, though. I mean,
No, he isn't. So maybe they could go back. But I'm just saying those two are not inextricably linked anymore. What HAL's been doing since Sakurai's departure is not very much in the way of high-profile stuff. They've done a lot of portable things. Some of their most recent endeavors are the Pokemon Ranger games. Oh. There was a new one just that came out in Japan that has yet to come out in the West, so we'll probably get that a little way down the line.
Yeah.
And then Picross 3D is HAL.
There you
so
go.
This is what they're doing currently. Other than the Kirby thing on consoles, I can't really think of anything they would be doing for Wii.
Not Kirby in general. I mean, they have made more Kirby games than I knew existed.
Something tells me they aren't making a Mother game.
Something tells me you're wrong, John.
I think Mother is over, but...
Now, I wouldn't be surprised if they're putting together the long-rumored Mother DS anthology, but besides that...
That would be amazing.
A new one.
They did Cabthus Curse, of course, which is really good.
It is.
Going back to the early days of DS. But subsequent to that, as we've discussed before, you know, like Squeak Squad, they didn't even do because it was handled by Flagship or something.
They had kind of the guiding hand role in that game.
That was outsourced. And, you know, so Kirby's been outsourced in places and stuff. So it's kind of, I said, how have not been that prolific with big projects?
I'm going to step out on a limb and say that HAL is going to do Smash Brothers for 3DS.
Well, we've been saying there's going to be a handheld Smash Brothers game since the Game Boy
Advance. It seems
Advance.
Like such a cash cow. Like, how can you not do
yeah,
it?
And, yeah, and on I DS, it really either. Wouldn't... You really can't run a Smash Brothers game on DS
that's
without
not true.
Turning it into like 2D sprites or something.
Well, yeah, but they could have done a sprite-based game. I mean, there are three games based on the Smash Brothers formula on the DS that are import.
Yeah, the Jump Ultimate Stars and all that stuff is pretty successful. It is odd that they haven't done it before, but perhaps that only reinforces the likelihood of it being done.
It's inevitable. There has to be a portable Smash Brothers at some point.
I do think, though, that to say they're working on that Kirby game is to say that I was working on the end of the year feature for the entirety of the time between January
yeah, well,
and
like Monolith
and
working on Disaster the whole time.
I mean, it might come up in a meeting every so often, and in the off time they might think, man, I wonder what Kirby's going to be like when it comes out. But it probably doesn't get a lot of their attention.
Then they have another shot.
Man, if this
and
is
laugh.
A lightning round, it's some slow-ass lightning. Moving on, Retro Studios.
Hell.
In the prediction show, I said they were going to do an open world game. I might as well stick with that.
Okay. I think they're doing nothing. I think they're just like, just F it.
They supposedly have a Wii project going on, but who cares at this point? Fuck off, sure. Retro Studios. I'm sick of you not doing anything for years.
Yeah. I saw a rumor on a message board, so maybe someone just, maybe it's just wishful thinking. But it got me thinking, and the rumor was that Retro Studios might be making Eternal Darkness 2.
That's random.
No way.
I was kind of hoping that Silicon Knights was making Eternal Darkness 2, and maybe they are. But some recent announcements, it actually sounds like...
I love that they said that they're working on a quote-unquote game for the next generation systems. Mm-hmm. How long did the Xbox 360 come out again? Was it 5 years? Next generation, really? Are we still calling it that?
Yeah, maybe they mean whatever the literal next systems are, but...
I mean, like, did they just confirm the next generation of consoles? Is it actually the one console future? Is that what they're working on?
Silicon Knights, no telling. But as far as retro goes, I think we will know in about 2 months what they're doing.
If they don't say what they're working on at E3, then the problems are a lot deeper than people know, but I don't believe that. I think they've got something. It probably would be out within a year of this E3.
It may very well be a Christmas game.
We just don't know what it is yet. The reason why I said open world game in the prediction show is because it's a genre that's underrepresented on Wii that they could bring something interesting to the table.
Maybe they'll go back and do a football or a racing game like their early...
Oh, God, no.
Next up, Nintendo Software Technologies. These are the people who brought you Mario vs. Donkey Kong 1 and 2. They did Bionic Commando Elite Forces. They did a port of Crystalis back in the day for Game Boy Color.
Oh, it was awful, too.
They did Wave Race Blue Storm on GameCube, as well as 1080 Avalanche.
Which was
on
basically
GameCube.
Just a port of the N64 game.
That's unkind.
They made a lot of Game Boy Color and GameCube games. Mm-hmm. They were working on Project Hammer at one point, and
yes,
we don't have any confirmation of this, but I think when Project Hammer was canceled, most of NST was canceled. Because they really have made jack shit in the past two or 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, most of their N64 games were really early games. Their GameCube games, sorry, yeah.
The most recent stuff I can think of is Portable, Prime Hunters, and March of the Minis. And then, of course, there's the Minis March again for DSiWare, but that's the bones of that obviously lie with the previous retail release.
Right.
So certainly the evidence very much points to what Johnny was saying, so I don't think we can expect very much from them.
At the very least, they've been restructured.
Downscaled.
I think they've been downsized a lot. They probably still exist in some form, but I don't know what they're working on. Not much, apparently.
Prime Hunters 2, The Dream Lives.
The world doesn't
3DS,
really...
babe.
The nightmare exists.
The world really doesn't need that.
I would be ecstatic.
It wasn't that bad.
No, it's not.
It's
a good game,
it's just... We just don't need more of it. So that's all I'm saying. I'm not saying it's bad.
We need much more of it, not just more of it. That's the difference. I want the trilogy.
So, Monolith. Of course, these are the people who brought you Disaster Day of Crisis and Kaitos 1 and 2.
Botten Kaitos, the Xenosaga games for the PlayStation 2.
Yes, and we know what they're working on. It's called Xenoblade.
That's coming out in Japan in June.
Yeah, so they definitely have something else underway because, I mean, there's 80 employees and the game's probably already done.
Presumably, Nintendo, after the disaster experiment, will continue to have them work strictly on RPGs. I assume that's what they bought them for.
Yeah, yes, it never made sense why they put them on that game. It's like, hey, you've never made anything but RPGs. Make this.
Yeah.
They do have a Super Robot Tyson game in the DS that they're working on, but does never make it out of Japan usually, so.
You know, Atlus actually brought one out last year.
Did they really?
I don't know why, but they did. So anyway, Project Sora. This is, of course, Masahiro Sakurai's.
James, you were trying to get to the bottom of this during the prediction show as well. Yes. What they were doing.
Project Sora is a company that has made nothing, effectively, except a website showing us how awesome their office is.
And remember, the words were, at the time when they announced the formation of the company, as a joint venture between Sakurai and Nintendo, that they were making a game that Nintendo could not make themselves. So read into that what you will.
It's so skeevy that he left the company so he could form other companies funded by the company.
Sort of like this sort of plausible deniability black ops thing.
We've talked about this at length, about what that might mean. And
it's just shady. It's so goddamn shady.
But Sakurai is, he's a great developer. I mean, you think even in the brief time that he wasn't with Nintendo in some form, what game did he make? Meteos. Awesome.
Yeah, that's an awesome game.
I trust Sakurai to make something great.
Johnny, trust him with level design, too?
No. I don't want him to make the new Kirby game, but I don't have to worry about that, because I think he kind of hates Kirby now. So
yeah, I think that's sort of bound up in his leaving, isn't it? Is what was going on with Kirby.
Right. So he won't be making Kirby. And I don't think his next game will be another Smash Brothers. But as for what it actually is, who can say? Creatures, Inc.
They're the Pokemon people.
Yep. They are the Pokemon people, and we know what they're making. It's called Pokemon Black and White.
Black and White, yes. Well, actually, they are one of the two Pokemon people, if you want to skip ahead to Genus Sonority, which is also the Pokemon people.
Well, Genius Sonority is a newer company, and they make mostly spin-offs of Pokemon.
They're
right?
The Pokemon B Team.
Yeah, and Dragon Quest B Team as well.
They're the Dragon Quest D Team.
They are, exactly.
So they made Colosseum, XD, Gale of Darkness, Troze, Battle Revolution, Dragon Quest Swords, and the, quote, 100 classic book collection.
Yes.
Thank you, Genius Sonority.
So Genius Sonority probably making like a Colosseum kind of thing for Black and White.
Or something Black and White related. They're probably making something awful. Let's just say it.
Yeah. Troze
something
3.
That we will not want.
All right. So there's an assortment of other studios, mostly in Japan. I don't know how much we can talk about all these, but Brownie Brown, Skip, Payon, NDQ, or some of that other stuff, Noise.
I guess the question with Skip is, will they ever work on something other than art style ever again?
Like, no, I don't necessarily want them to, unless, I mean, they've already made, like, was it 3 different custom Robo games?
Which were Chibi-Robo.
Chibi-Robo, I'm sorry. Yeah, custom Robo is Noise.
Well, they made, of course, a second Chibi-Robo DS game, which at the minute is restricted only to Japan.
Right.
Right.
So they have been doing other stuff for DSiWare.
Yeah. They make weird stuff, basically.
Whether there'll be further Chibi-Robo stuff doesn't look good for every... If it's made, it probably won't come elsewhere because new Play Control and the new DS game have not been localized.
Right. Yeah, it seems like NOA is not really interested in Chibi-Robo, but... I'm pretty happy for Skip to keep pumping out art style games, basically.
Yeah.
And they've already got 2 or 3 more announced that are coming to WiiWare and DSiWare, so...
We have Brownie Brown, which we can talk about quickly. They basically make the Sekai Densu games.
They did
RPGs.
Magical Vacation 1 and 2, neither of which came to America.
They contributed to the development of Mother 3, which really involved about 3 Nintendo teams.
They did Blue Dragon, Plus as well.
Yeah, Blue Dragon Plus, Professor Layton and the Devil's Flute, which is the most recent one.
Yeah, the reason why they're credited on that Layton is because they made the little Layton RPG that's like an unlockable game within the game.
Oh, nice.
The London Life, I believe, is what it's called, yes.
Nice.
So the odds are they're working on some kind of handheld RPG because that's all they've ever done.
That's what they do. Yeah, no, they're made up of some former Square people.
Yeah, and they were funded with some Square and Nintendo money, if I recall correctly.
So that is a very long answer to one of 3 questions in one of 4 emails in the second of 2 segments in this podcast.
That's about as lightning round as we get, I think.
Right.
On this podcast.
We don't do anything quickly on this show, do we? So we're going to have to cut it off and end this episode. Before we go, please check out our other podcast, The Newscast, as it was mentioned in Now Playing, and of course Radio Trivia Podcast Edition, which should be getting a new episode soon. And the other thing is, don't forget about Retroactive. pick up your copy of Metroid 2 wherever you can, and get ready for that. The thread to start discussing it will go up in the forum soon. We'll be posting there as well, and then we will draw comments from that thread and bring them onto the show once we talk about it, which will be coming up soon. So we will see you in 2 weeks. Till then, take care.
Bye.
Later.
Bye-bye.
So are you going to pay all that money for the maps you already have, pack?
Actually, I did get the map pack. That was one of the things that I was
going to
hold off on it, but I was just like, eh.
So he just spent all this time bad-mouthing Modern Warfare's maps. Said, all right, I'm going to pay for them.
Oh, what the?
Hopefully there are a couple of the better ones, though.
What, for the stimulus package?
Yeah, you get a couple of ones from the previous game.
Oh, do you? I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Zach is our official reviewer of games that are 6 to 12 months old.
Clean up, man.
I thought I was. Well, oh, hey. Yeah.
Ooh. Was that a self-troll?
Yeah, I had to troll myself. Because I know everybody's thinking it, so I have to say it.
Sometimes the low-hanging fruit hangs from you.
Oh, the sad thing was I was thinking it just as he said it.
I know.
And I love poutine. I have this fascination with poutine. If anyone doesn't know, poutine is basically... How can you not like that?
So good.
That sounds dirty. And I hope Greg isolates that and just plays it at the end.